I will be reading Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 13. Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 13. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they came from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands?" He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites, as it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules.' You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions." As he continued, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death. But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father and mother is Corban, that is devoted to God, then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down, and you do many things like that."
I have an object lesson, because I was told one time that object lessons are good devices for making sure people remember things that you may say. So today I have an object lesson. It's this. Okay? This is a Mobile Christian football jersey, circa 1980, none of your business. Circa 1985-86. And it's really cool because how it doesn't cover anything below, like right here, you know, if you wear it like that. What's even cooler is the shirt you wear under the pads that only came down to about right here. I wish I could tell you a lot of great stories about wonderful triumphs and championships related to this shirt, but I can't because we were terrible. I was a terrible football player. My brother was very athletic, tall, strong, fast. None of those things I got, thanks to my parents. I blame them. But I loved, when I was a kid, going to the games. I was a big fan when I was a little kid. Danny played on the very first football team we ever had. And man, I loved going to those games. And just, you know, watching him and watching Rick and Yancey and other guys that played on those teams, and I was a big fan. So I played when I got to be in high school. We were awful. But the story is really not about football and about the shirt. I want you to take close note of something about this shirt that if you haven't already picked up on, maybe I can share with you. I want you to notice what color this shirt is. Okay? I don't know who decided these things in life. Somewhere there was a meeting when Mobile Christian first was formed, or at some point somebody sat around an office and said, "Hey, we got to have some colors, and we got to have a mascot." I wasn't part of that meeting. That happened a long time ago. Some of you may have been part of that meeting. I don't know. Somebody decided we were going to be blue and gold, and somebody decided we were going to be the leopards. Now, if I had been there, I might have said something different. I don't know, but it wasn't me. It was a long time ago. Somebody decided we were going to be blue and gold. And for a long time, blue and gold meant royal blue and this maize color here. Sort of like LSU wears. And it looked good. It pops out, right? Kind of has a good look to it. But that was blue and gold. And I cheered for the blue and gold all my life. Wore this. I, you know, had some blood and some sweat and some tears right here in this blue and gold. It meant a lot to me. And then school ended. And I did like everybody else. I went off. After a few years being gone, I come back to town, move my family, got a baby, got a new career, got a new little house, setting things up. I want to go back to school. I'm going to go and enjoy what I used to enjoy on Friday night. And maybe baseball games. Some things I enjoy doing. I want to go watch those things. Well, I went. And I was appalled. I was shocked. I was blown away. Somebody, while I was gone from high school through college, had decided that we were not going to be royal blue and maize anymore. Somebody decided our team needed to look like Notre Dame. Seriously. I go to the first football game and this like little mini Notre Dame runs out there. They got on these shiny gold helmets. They got on these navy jerseys and they got on these shiny gold pants. I'm like, who is this? Nobody wrote me a letter as an alumni saying we're considering changing the colors of the uniforms. There will be high-level meetings. I'm writing strongly worded letters. I might even use this newfangled thing called email to write an email to somebody expressing how disappointed I was Friday night to see that my beloved blue and gold is now looks like Notre Dame. What if I, in that moment of frustration and heartburn, had decided, you know what? They've crossed the line with me. This is what the colors are. I'm done with them. I'm done with them. I'm not going to support it. I'm not going to send my kids there. I'm not going back out there to that campus. They can forget me, buddy. They can scratch my name off the list. I no longer have anything to do with them. They don't care any more about the colors than that. I'm gone. Now, how many of you on the outside looking in would look at my attitude and think, well, that's a really mature and adult and productive attitude there, Mark. That's really the way to handle your situation. And you know what? As my children began to become involved in school and I began to go to more things and see things, you know what hadn't changed? It was still the school. The point of the game was still to win, compete, and win. Even though they were wearing a slightly different color blue and a slightly different color gold, the purpose was the same. It was for kids to go to school to learn to read, write, and count. And when they got on the field, it was to compete to win. That part hadn't changed. And my children came up through, and now for the greater part of 20 years, I've become kind of accustomed to what they call Navy and Vegas gold, which is kind of funny, Mobile Christian School wearing Vegas gold. I just want you all to stop and think about that for just a second. We should blame Notre Dame for that, maybe. I don't know. But I've become accustomed to it. It doesn't bother me anymore. And frankly, I don't know who made the decision to change from the traditional royal blue and maize to navy and Vegas gold. I have a feeling maybe my cousin Rick had something to do with it. I don't know. We can blame him. But I got used to it. I got over it. But it hurt my feelings there for a little bit that they had trampled on the cherished tradition of the blue and gold. Jesus talks to these Pharisees in Mark 7 we were just reading. And he's going to address a couple of things that they had been doing traditionally for a long time. The first was this idea of ceremonial washing. Now, we can go all the way back to the Levitical law, and God gave the Israelites a lot of instructions on how to be clean. Why? Because you had about 1 million people leave Egypt who were all living in a camp and traveling together through the desert, and were going to be living in close quarters. He gave them a lot of these instructions to be sanitary so they wouldn't kill each other with diseases. So he taught them how to handle their food. He taught them how to handle their waste. He taught them how to stay clean because he knew if disease broke out, it could wipe out a large number of the people. So he gave them a lot of instructions. When he instituted tabernacle worship, later to be the temple worship, he incorporated these washings for the priests before they would do their priestly service. Some included the entire immersion of the priest in water as a part of the ceremonial cleansing, something that was very close in design to the way baptism works in the New Testament. But one of these was this idea of ceremonially washing your hands. Now, through time, these Jews had created this elaborate ceremony. At every point in the day, they were to have these washed hands. In fact, they developed these special canisters or pitchers or bowls that they would use. And they literally would have this, you know, once, twice, three, once, twice, three. Hey, I've washed my hands. And if you didn't do that, your hands were considered unclean. And that is what they were accusing the disciples of not doing before they sat down to eat their meal. They didn't do this Jewish ceremonial cleansing, this little ritual that the Jews said they had to do. So it also applied to the priest, and over time it had developed into this long-standing ceremony that they would do. And that's what Jesus was addressing. Now, he also addresses a second tradition that they had, and that is this idea of Corban. That is, I'm dedicating my goods to God's purpose. I'm going to, basically, it's almost like an estate will. I'm willing my material goods to the temple to care for the priest and to basically provide for the service at the temple. Now, that doesn't sound bad. That sounds like a positive thing. Anything dedicated as a sacrificial offering in support of the temple. Over time, however, over time, the Jews had started to use this in a legalistic way to basically exempt their personal property from being able to be levied upon to pay a debt. It was sort of like exempting your property from creditors. You could say to somebody that you had borrowed money from and you owed money back, you know, I'd love to sell this piece of property and give you the money that I owe you from that sale, but I've made that property Corban. I've dedicated it to God. Sorry. I'd love to pay you back. Here's the trick. You didn't have to give up the property to dedicate it. You got to keep it. You could use it. You could hang on to it. But you could also shelter it from anybody taking it from you to pay a debt. That's what they had done with this concept. So, Jesus points out, you could literally have a starving, destitute parent who needs your help, but you could feel good about hanging on to your property and not helping your aged parent by saying, well, you know, I've dedicated that property to God. And there your parents are starving. And Jesus says, how dare you? How dare you hold a tradition above the purpose? Jesus wasn't against being clean. He wasn't against having clean hands when you sat down to eat. He wasn't against dedicating what God had provided to you back to God. That's a very scriptural approach to material wealth, dedicating it to God. What was he against? He was against elevating the practice above the purpose. Do we all get that? This practice of washing your hands was more important than the worship to God. This idea of dedicating your property was more important than caring for your family. That's what he was against. When we place a practice in priority over the purposes God has given us, Jesus says our attempts to worship will be vain. Does everybody understand that? When we place the practice over the purpose, Jesus tells the Pharisees, your worship is vain. In that way, this tradition of the elders he speaks to has now become an idol. It is literally something between the worshiper and God that prevents the worshiper from truly worshiping God. Okay? Anything artificial that we place between us and God, by definition, is an idol. And it causes our worship attempts to be vanity. In Exodus, back in 32, we got the story of the golden calf. Got a little picture of it there. It's a pretty nice little picture. I want you to see what Aaron does here. Aaron was caught in between the people and God, really. He was succumbing to the pressure of the people to give them this representation of God they could follow, and he did it. And then he says, well, let's do this. Let's kind of cut it down the middle. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to who? The calf? No. There'll be a festival to Yahweh in the Hebrew, the Lord. So Aaron has set up this altar in front of this image, but yet still thinks that somehow they're going to have this festival that Yahweh, God, is going to be pleased with. And we know that is idol worship. It was vain worship. God was displeased with that. He caused the people to suffer the 40 years in the wilderness. None of them got to see the promised land. Moses broke the tablets of the Ten Commandments on the calf, destroyed it, made them drink it, scattered the ashes in the water, made them drink the water, the bitter remnant of the idol. So anything we place between us and God is an idol. Now, so what exactly do clean hands and golden calves have to do with Sunday night? That's the question we want to ask today. If we demand, as a test of fellowship, adherence to any tradition that is not required by Scripture, then we are, in essence, as Jesus told the Pharisees, creating an idol of that tradition. If we demand by test of fellowship adherence to a tradition that is not demanded in Scripture, then we by definition have created an idol between us and God. Now, can you think of any examples? Well, I'm going to use one that probably has nothing to do with anybody in here, but we talk about it a lot, so it's easy to talk about. It doesn't hurt our feelings that much. There was a time when brethren within churches of Christ drew a line in the sand saying that when we gathered for Sunday morning communion, we better have one cup to drink from, because that's, in their opinion, the scriptural way to do it, and to deviate from the one cup is a test of fellowship. You are no longer a Christian if you agree to use multiple cups. And they divided churches, divided families, divided brethren over the issue of whether or not we could divide the grape juice into multiple cups for people to use, or we all had to sip from the same cup. And you might say, well, that sounds kind of ridiculous. Well, maybe it is. But you would think that's something in the past, but let me just tell you, on the other side of the Lord's Supper table, within the last 2 weeks, I have had a conversation with a concerned brother about a congregation, and I'll just say within 50 miles of where we stand today, where brethren are splitting, have split, have left the congregation to worship elsewhere over the fact that somebody suggested that on the communion bread that they use these little pre-prepared, pre-broken squares of communion bread as opposed to the cracked up cracker chunk in there that you actually reach in and grab and pinch off. And this, in the last 2 weeks, this group of brethren have made a fellowship issue, a test of brotherhood over whether you have to literally crack the cracker open and eat it, or off and eat it, or whether you can reach in and grab a piece that's already been broken and made that way and eat it for communion. So these things still happen. And I suggest to us today that when we put these practices and traditions above the purpose, that we're creating false idols that cause division. What are the rules about meeting as a church? Well, let me just tell you, there aren't many. I don't want to shock you today, but there aren't many rules about meeting as a church. And I want to say this. It is part of the miraculous providence of God and His wisdom that He created so few rules about being a Christian and how to worship. Because in that simplicity is the ability to do it anywhere we go. Do we not understand that concept? Jesus, God made worship to Him simple so it could be replicated over and over and over, thousands of miles apart, thousands and millions of people across the world could do it. It didn't require a special location in Jerusalem. It didn't require a special altar in the temple. It didn't require a special bull to sacrifice. It was simple and it was able to be replicated anywhere Christians lived. It didn't require a sanctuary. It didn't require special anything except to be able to come together and have common elements of fruit of the vine and unleavened bread. That is in the wisdom of God to do that. So the rules about when we meet are pretty simple. Outside the example that we have to meet on the first day to worship, there is not one word of Scripture directing at what time we are to meet, how many times we are to meet, or how long each of our meetings are to last. Can we all be clear about that? There's not one word of Scripture that dictates what time we have to meet on Sunday, how many times we have to meet on Sunday, or how long we have to meet on Sunday. It's just that we meet on Sunday. We have two examples. Acts 20 and 7 is where Paul preached till midnight. That's the famous verse about Paul preaching to midnight because he was getting ready to leave the next day. He had a lot to say to them. But they met on the first day of the week and he preached till midnight. The other in 1 Corinthians is where it says you come together on the first day of the week, lay by in store, so that when I come, there'll be no need to gather. In other words, Paul says, have your donations together. When I come to take them for the famine relief in Jerusalem, it'll be all gathered together and I'll be able to get it. So those are the two examples we have. Outside of that, it is up to the discretion of the congregation's elders to set aside the times on Sunday that the congregation will come together for worship. That's just the way it is. So how did the tradition of a Sunday evening service start? And I'm going to call it a tradition. How did the tradition of the Sunday evening service start? Some people will point all the way back, if I have the laser pointer, 112 A.D. Now, I want y'all to take a note of that. 112 A.D., that's a long way back there. This little excerpt is from a letter of Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan. Real quick background. Pliny the Younger was like the governor of a certain area in what is modern-day Turkey. He had a province. It's kind of like Pilate. He was Pliny the Younger. This letter from 112 A.D., is the oldest non-scriptural reference to Christianity or Christians that we know to exist. Okay? So, as we believe it, the book of Revelation was written around 90, right before John died. That was the end of scriptural writing. So here we are in 112, just a decade or so later. This is the oldest known reference to Christianity outside of the Bible itself. The interesting part here, why did Pliny write the letter? Well, Pliny the governor wrote the letter to the emperor because he was running into these people called Christians and he wanted to know how to deal with them. They weren't worshiping the Roman gods. They weren't worshiping the emperor, and he was having some problems, and he wanted to know how the emperor wanted him to deal with them. It was a political problem. And there had been an edict issued that there would be no worship in the Roman Empire except the worship of the emperor. So Pliny was saying, hey, I got this problem. And the letter is interesting because of what he had done. He said, you know, I went out and I talked to some of these people. I interrogated a few of them. And frankly, when they would not denounce Jesus, I executed them. A few. But I realize now that if I start doing this, I'm going to execute a lot of people. What do you want me to do? And he says, what's interesting, he says, I interrogated two young slave girls known as, and this is his words, known as deaconesses, as to what they do. What is being a Christian? And they explained to him, as he wrote to the emperor, that basically what he found was that they were accustomed to meeting on a fixed day before dawn, sing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by oath, not to do some crime or to commit a fraud, but to not do bad. And then, when it was over, it was their custom to depart and assemble again and partake of food. Ordinary food. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is just an objective observer of Christianity in the second century, giving us an explanation of how they operated. So, what do we take away from that? Well, first of all, next Sunday morning, we will meet at 4 o'clock a.m. before dawn. All right? That's it. Have a good afternoon. The reality is that Sunday in the ancient world was a day. It wasn't Sunday like we look at the weekend. It was a work day. If you had a job to do, you had to do it on Sunday. If you had a business you ran, you had to run it on Sunday. If you had a trade to ply, you had to ply it on Sunday. If you were a slave and you had a master, you were responsible to whatever the master wanted you to do on Sunday, just like you were any other day of the week. So what I surmise from this comment is that it was convenient as a way of avoiding the controversy of missing work to meet before the work day started. And so they would get up in the dark of morning and meet together to worship, because when the sun came up, the work day started. And they would go to work. And I think what we learn here is that when the work day was over, they set aside time to try to come back together at night, that night, to eat together in fellowship, enjoy each other's company for a few minutes before they started the work day Monday. Now, that's how they did it under their circumstances. And it makes sense. Sunday evening services throughout modern Reformation served a number of different purposes. People in the Calvin tradition, he liked to have a Sunday afternoon meeting to teach the catechism, that is discipleship training on points of doctrine. So he would meet on Sunday afternoon, and this developed into a Sunday afternoon meeting in addition to the Sunday morning worship. And I should note here that many of the American Restoration Movement ministers, Alexander Campbell, Thomas Campbell, Barton Stone, all came out of the Presbyterian tradition. So this idea of meeting on Sunday afternoon for training was something they would have been trained in college to do. Makes some sense. The Puritans and the Reformed Anglican Church here in the United States, they moved over. This is the Mayflower. They came over. They were looking for religious freedom. You know what they did? They were establishing Sunday as a new Sabbath, a day of rest. They didn't want the members doing other things on Sunday, so they started having a second service on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evenings, as basically a way to prevent the members from leaving church on Sunday morning and going and doing other recreations or entertainments. It's crowd control. It's behavior control. That was the decision they made. Some focused on youth activities. The Baptist had what they called the Baptist Young People's Union on Sunday evening as a tradition in the 1800s, which eventually sort of boiled down to what we know today as the Baptist Student Union on most universities. It's the same tradition. The Danish Lutherans had multi-language services. So the Sunday evening service was for those who had a different language. Pretty practical, made some sense. Part of our own tradition is this idea of circuit preachers. One preacher would travel to multiple places to preach over the course of a week or a month. And so one group may meet Sunday morning in town A, and the other group in town B, where the preacher was going, may meet on Sunday evening. He would go preach to them. Now, maybe the group in town B, they may come together and have a worship on Sunday morning with just some limited, with communion and just limited service, but wait for the preacher to come Sunday afternoon and come back to the church so they could hear the sermon. And this was fairly common. As we move into modern times, particularly in the run-up to the Second World War and through the Second World War, we had the advent of 24/7 production. In order to support the military, to build up the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines for World War II, we had to have the workforce of the United States working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop, to build what we needed. And so we had this idea of round-the-clock shifts. It's a modern development. So you might have a person that would go in to work at 7 on Sunday morning at the shipyard in Chickasaw. He may not get off until 3, 3:30 Sunday afternoon from the shipyard. So we would have a church service in the evening. So that person who had worked shift work at the shipyard could come and have worship. That makes sense. The point of that is that each in their own way may have been pretty good reasons for having this second meeting of the saints on any given Sunday. They were all pretty good reasons. Okay? There's nothing wrong with getting together and having training. We do it in Sunday school. That's what we're supposed to do in Sunday school. There's nothing wrong with having youth events. Focus on youth. That's a great point to get back together. There's certainly nothing wrong with providing opportunities for worship when people are prohibited from doing so. All those were pretty good ideas. But in each, it was the discretionary choice of the church leaders as to the times to use that best suited their situation. As long as they were meeting the demand or command to meet on Sunday morning for worship or meet on Sunday for worship, it really didn't matter what time. It didn't matter how often. They were trying to do things that best suited their church. Sam Foss was an American poet, lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he wrote these words. And I kind of want us to listen to these words as we consider how tightly we hold to certain traditions. One day, through the primeval wood, a calf walked home, as good calves should, but made a trail all bent askew, a crooked trail, as all calves do. Since then, 300 years have fled, and I infer the calf is dead. But still he left behind the trail, and hereby hangs my moral tale. The trail was taken up the next day by a lone dog who passed that way. And then a wise bellwether sheep pursued the trail or vale and steep, and drew the flock behind him too, as good bellwethers always do. And from day to day, o'er hill and glade, through those old woods a path was made. And many men wound in and out, and dodged and turned and bent about, and uttered words of righteous wrath, because 'twas such a crooked path. But still they followed, do not laugh, the first migrations of that calf. And through this winding woodway stalked, because he wobbled when he walked. The forest path became a lane, and bent and turned again. This crooked lane became a road where many a poor horse with his load toiled on beneath the burning sun and traveled some 3 miles in one. And thus a century and a half they trod the footsteps of that calf. The years passed on in swiftness fleet. The road became a village street, and this before men were aware, a city's crowded thoroughfare. And soon the central street was this of a renowned metropolis. And men 2 centuries and a half trod in the footsteps of that calf. Each day 100,000 rout followed the zigzag calf about, and o'er his crooked journey went the traffic of a continent. 100,000 men were led by one calf near 3 centuries dead. They followed his crooked way and lose 100 years a day. For thus such reverence is lent to well-established precedent. A moral lesson this might teach, were I ordained or called to preach. For men are prone to go it blind along the calf paths of the mind, and work away from sun to sun to do what other men have done. They follow in the beaten track, and out and in, and forth and back, and still their devious course pursue to keep the path that others do. They keep the path a sacred groove along which all their lives they move. And how the wise old wood gods laugh who saw that first primeval calf. Ah, what many things this tale might teach, but I am not ordained to preach. As we examine our practices, the elders of this church want nothing more than to encourage your spirituality, your walk with God. And they want to employ, I can assure you, we want to employ the very best plan that will assist each and every one of you in fulfilling all that God has in store for you. And if that means re-examining a tradition that we don't know who made, we don't know why it's that way, it just is the way it is. If it means re-examining one of those traditions or two, then perhaps it will be worth it to ensure that we are all moving together forward toward what God's will has in store for each of us. That's our goal. That's the point of the exercise. To allay any fears, to sort of lessen any anxiety. Our goal is to try to make sure this congregation is meeting all the potential God has for us, and using our time wisely to do so, whatever that may mean. But you know, that's for those who are part of our fellowship, who are part of our church. There may be those today who are on a different path. They are on a groove of the world. They are on the sacred path of human instinct, human desire. They're not even on the same path that we're on. And I want to speak to you today, if you have not committed your life to Jesus Christ, to do so before it's too late to get on that path. To consider following the world, as we talked about that poor lonely calf wandering through the woods, bringing 100,000 people behind it. That's sort of what sin does. Sin entices you just to get in with the flow and roll along. And so if you are here today and that is a problem for you, that you have not committed yourself to Jesus, we want you to take care of that before you leave. If you are part of our membership and you feel like there are things that have caused you to go along with the wrong path too long, we want you to consider that today, and anything that we can do to assist you, pray for you, we want to do. What we don't want to do as Christians is become so numb by routine, numb by tradition, that we lose the purpose of why we meet. The true purpose of why we meet. And so if anybody today needs the prayers of this church, we'll be glad to pray with you about anything that you have an issue in your life. If we can assist you in becoming a Christian today, we want you to please consider that decision and come forward as we stand together and sing.